The Highland Clearances are probably the most emotive episode in Scottish history, and there can be no more evocative or appropriate location than our present venue here in Croyk to deliver a lecture dealing with the great interrelated themes of the Christian faith and the land question. Like the great Shakespearean dramas, it is the element of human tragedy which makes the clearances so important and worthy of close attention. We cannot brush these events under the historical carpet, nor can we understand, as Professor Hunter has already said, nor can we understand the Highlands of our own day without some comprehension of the great social and economic changes of the period from 1750 until 1850. Now, the events of the early 19th century in particular were fueled by various economic and social factors, especially the great upheavals caused by the creation of the world's first industrial economy, dramatically increased population levels, and the general sense that the old run-rig system had had its day, provided their own pressures. Again, the political unease among the ruling elite caused by the French Revolution is a critical point to bear in mind in evaluating the actions of landowners at this time. But above all, it was the collapse of the traditional kin-based order of the old Highlands which intensified the loss of morale and enabled landlords to effect such sweeping changes to the lives of their tenants with so little serious opposition. A new ideology was needed to bring the Highland people to terms with the harsh realities of the modern world. Into this vacuum came evangelical Protestantism. The impact of a specifically Calvinist evangelicalism on Highland society was massive and far-reaching. Its uncompromising modernism radically altered the beliefs and value system of individuals and communities throughout the region. By means of education, itinerant preaching, and most important of all, revivalism, evangelicalism became indigenized and fundamentally altered the way Highlanders thought about themselves and the world. In areas such as East of Ross and Sutherland, where Presbyterianism had long been dominant, the revivals of the post-1750 period gave added strength to homegrown evangelicalism, which was then exported further west in the early 19th century. Various historians regard the rapid success of evangelicalism as being an effect of widespread economic fragility and the accompanying sense of social dislocation and psychological unease. While it is probably true that the destruction of traditional society played some role in preparing many communities for the reception of evangelicalism, we must be wary of an overly mechanistic interpretation, not least for the fact that there is little clear evidence of a temporal link between evictions and revivals in specific localities. It must always be remembered that experiences of conversion and revival were profoundly spiritual phenomena for those involved. If anything, the triumph of evangelicalism was facilitated by the lack of any convincing ideological or spiritual alternative in Gaelic society. Douglas Anstall has argued that Highlanders were poorly equipped to resist evangelical Christianity in the early 19th century. Many have posited the view that evangelical Calvinism produced a fatalistic passivity which destroyed traditional Gaelic society. Yet this position has little foundation in historical evidence. If anything, passive obedience and cultural modernism were a reaction against the destruction of the traditional kin-based society. Evangelicals and other leading churchmen were determined to maintain law and order, and this message was largely, but not always entirely, accepted by their congregations. In encouraging passivity before the forces of the state, they never wavered throughout the whole of the 19th century. What did change, however, was their increased willingness to criticise the existing arrangements of society. A major contention of this lecture is that evangelical leaders significantly forwarded the defence of Highland community values by developing a critique of the status quo. As we shall see, this process reached a crescendo in the 1880s during the Crofters' War. I need scarcely remind you here tonight that the role of the church in the great drama of the clearances is one which has attracted a great deal of comment. Much of this has not been as rigorously grounded in historical evidence as we might wish. And, much as we might sympathise with the moral indignation expressed in Donald MacLeod of Strathnaver's accounts in his gloomy memories from the Highlands of Scotland, it has to be said that his accounts of the Sutherland clergy have been applied to the totality of Highland ministers in an unwarranted manner. The response of the ministers to the clearances has often been characterised as a mixture of callous indifference, cowering deference, or a mind-numbing fatalism. I would like to suggest that this is a distortion of the overall picture, and that if we take the 19th century as a whole, the role of the church was much more positive than has usually been suggested. Now, there was never any suggestion that the church should encourage violent opposition to the evicting proprietors. Such would have run in the face of centuries of Christian social teaching and the unambiguous statements of Scripture. For example, Christ's statement in the Sermon on the Mount, quote, "But I say unto you that ye resist not evil, but whosoever shall smite thee on thy right cheek, turn to him the other also," end quote. Ministers were in a very difficult position, since, on the one hand, they were the face of a church given legal status and privileges by the British state, and yet were acknowledged leaders in their own communities. The tension between upholding the rights, the legal rights of proprietors, and yet providing pastoral succour for their congregations must have been a tremendous burden for Highland clergymen. There is also the question as to just what exactly the ministers had to do to escape from the criticism that they had failed the people in their hour of need. We need also to bear in mind the fact that many present-day conceptions of the role of the church are rather different to that which prevailed in the early 19th century. Presbyterians then held to the teachings of the Westminster Confession of Faith regarding the role of church courts, for example. Quote, "Synods and councils are to handle or conclude nothing but that which is ecclesiastical, and are not to meddle with civil affairs which concern the commonwealth, unless by way of humble petition, in cases extraordinary, or by way of advice, for satisfaction of conscience, if they be thereunto required by the civil magistrate," end quote. This statement was based on the words of Christ, when asked by the man to persuade his brother to divide an inheritance with him, quote, "Man, who made me a judge or divider over you?" End quote. And again Christ told Pilate that, quote, "If my kingdom were of this world, then would my servants fight." Yet the same Puritan divines who wrote the confession also stated in their larger catechism that among the breaches of the eighth commandment, thou shalt not steal, where, quote, removing landmarks, injustice and unfaithfulness in contracts between man and man, oppression, extortion, usury, bribery, vexatious lawsuits, unjust enclosures and depopulations, and all other unjust or sinful ways of taking or withholding from our neighbour what belongs to him. End quote. The church, therefore, was primarily spiritual in its role and was not to become too concerned with civil affairs. At the same time, though, it was legitimate, indeed obligatory, to criticise acts of oppression. All in all, it was a difficult balancing act in a time when landlords held their appointments and the stipends of so many ministers in their own hands. Following on from that, it must have appeared obvious to these ministers, whether moderates or evangelicals, that the landlord's overwhelming legal and economic strength would inevitably suppress active opposition to clearances. Furthermore, early 19th century clergymen were only two or three generations removed from the repression which followed the Battle of Culloden. They clearly had no wish to provoke an establishment which was quite willing to use troops to enforce its property rights, as happened in Easter Ross in 1792. Nonetheless, evidence exists to show that ministerial attitudes to the earlier clearances in Sutherland and elsewhere were less quiescent than Donald MacLeod's gloomy memories would suggest. The opposition of Lachlan Mackenzie of Lochcarn to sheep clearances during the 1810s is well documented. Other ministers, such as Alexander MacLeod of Harris and Alexander Sage of Kildonan, also opposed evictions in their parishes. John MacDonald of Helmsdale, an evangelical in the established church, became renowned for his passionate denunciation of the clearances, despite being the son of a Sutherland estate ground officer. MacDonald's diary entry for 11th of August 1840, when half of his salary was still paid by the Duke of Sutherland, records that he preached at Kildonan. He preached at Kildonan from Psalm 75, verse 8. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red. In this sermon, he referred to, quote, the judgments of the Lord, turning the country into a desolate waste, the parish being all converted into sheep walks. Linking this with a parallel passage in Jeremiah, he threatened that, quote, Lord's judgments also in his own time against those who were the means of doing so. End quote. These examples demonstrate that clerical responses to the clearances within the established church in this period were more varied than has generally been believed. David Peyton has reassessed the reputation of David Mackenzie of Farr and other Sutherland ministers in a more positive light. Nevertheless, Peyton sees a Calvinist theology of self-abasement as having a negative impact on the people, hampering the development of social criticism and the will to organise effective resistance. I would argue, on the contrary, that the ability of a society to cope with extreme suffering in a non-violent and dignified fashion was a mark not of demoralisation, but of great moral depth and resilience. Although Eric Richards has demonstrated that Highlanders were not altogether as passive as is sometimes believed, it remains true that the Christian message of the acceptance of suffering had obviously been deeply absorbed into the Highland psyche. Did the church then teach the people that the evictions were a divine punishment for sin, as Donald MacLeod of Strathnaver alleged? Yes and no. The problem must be seen through the lens of providentialism, which was a key component of early 19th century thinking throughout Britain. Consistent theism, and Calvinism especially, holds that an omnipotent God is necessarily in control of all events that come to pass, including all the sin and evil in the world. Without going too far into the realm of theodicy, Highland Calvinists would have held that God permitted the clearances for reasons known to himself, but only partly knowable by us. Since all human wickedness can be traced to the fall of man and the entrance of sin into the world, the clearances and all the other calamities that befell Highland tenants were certainly caused by sin. But whose sin? The laird's or the tenants? Well, ultimately, the divine will in providence was mysterious and inscrutable, and it would be dangerous to be over-specific in apportioning blame. Thomas Chalmers warned against the dangers of specifying the causes of the famine in the 1840s, for example, quoting the words, "Except ye repent, ye shall all likewise perish." Chalmers wrote, quote, "We hold it to be extremely hazardous, nay often presumptuous and unwarrantable in the highest degree, to pronounce on the special delinquency that may have called forth some temporal infliction in the form of a penalty or chastisement." End quote. Whatever the individual sins of oppression perpetrated by landlords may have been, the pious Highland Calvinist would have seen evictions, poverty and famine in the same light as he would have seen every other affliction in this life, as events within the unfathomable control of a holy yet benevolent God, and as being less than his sins deserved. Yet, since the divine will and providence operated through the liberty and spontaneity of secondary causes, this providentialist doctrine was compatible with moral responsibility and the condemnation of oppression. In other words, men act freely and responsibly according to their nature, but behind it all is the infinite wisdom of the Almighty, who has ordained and permitted the free acts of men. If a laird or factor oppressed his people or neglected their welfare, he alone was culpable according to the divine law, and it was certainly a greater judgment on the lairds to be permitted to oppress than it was to be oppressed. This point emerges very strongly in the post-disruption era, when free church ministers felt much freer to criticise landlords. But however inhibited ministers may have been by their social position before 1843, the intellectual tools to construct a critique of the clearances were certainly in place. This was seen more evidently after the disruption, which largely crystallised the existing division between moderates and evangelicals along the denominational lines of the established and free churches. The effect of this was that the Free Church took on the role of the Church of the Highlands because of its dominant position in the crofting areas of the North and West. By virtue of its own ecclesiastical and social position, the Free Church found itself opposed by proprietors who resented the new church's egalitarian, anti-patronage stance as an infringement of their own property rights. What could be more natural than that the Free Church, as a body, should become more outspoken in its criticism of layers and should advocate the claims of the downtrodden tenantry instead? This was seen here at Glencalvie in the infamous events of 1845. Although the public outcry was insufficient to prevent the removal of the people, the role of the Free Church ministers, Hector Allen, Gustavus Aird, and George Kennedy, in raising funds for the destitute families, was an indication of the fact that the new denomination was clearly aligning itself with the common people against the landlords. The 1845 Free Church Assembly met in Inverness, expressly in order to show solidarity with the Highland people. And each collision with landowners over site refusal or the eviction of tenants who espoused the Free Church cause was skillfully used by the new church to influence public opinion. In the very same year, for example, the Free Church magazine queried, quote, "Dare man insult his maker by rendering the laws of property stronger than the laws of God? Again, we earnestly implore our landed aristocracy, for their own sakes, to change their course, lest their bands be made strong till the hour of retribution come." End quote. Further opportunity was afforded Free Churchmen to show their sympathies with the crofting population during the wave of famine, destitution, and forced evictions of the late 1840s and early 1850s. The rapid response of the Free Church Destitution Committee and the philanthropy of urban congregations ensured that the potato blight did not have anything like the same impact as it did in Ireland. What is also highly significant is that leading figures in the Free Church, such as Mackintosh Mackay, Thomas McLaughlin, and James Begg, were quick to inquire into the human causes which lay behind the impoverishment of the crofting population and which left them so heavily dependent on the potato in the first place. The conclusion they reached was in agreement with the title of a book published in 1855 by Eric Finlitter, Free Church Minister of Balquhidder, namely that Highland clearances were the real cause of Highland famines. Finlitter, a Sutherland native, wrote, quote, "We hold the sin of this system to be in the oppression of the poor which it has caused, in the ties it has broken, in the hearts it has torn, in the hearths it has quenched, in the family altars it has trodden down, in the tabernacles of praise it has silenced, in the justice and judgment it has perverted, in the hearts it has made callous, in the fortunes it has made on the ruins of those of others, in its having traversed laws, natural, social, and moral, and in having made a comparative wilderness of a land once full of inhabitants, and filling it, not with brave men who in the hour of the nation's danger were its boldest defenders, but with the lower animals that minister to men's appetites and pleasures. And if this be not enough to stamp a system as a national sin, we know not what is." End quote. Despite the flood of emigration, many leading figures in the Free Church were beginning to call for land reform instead of depopulation as the solution. Thomas McLaughlin argued that the region could actually sustain a much higher population if the land were equitably distributed. Roderick MacLeod of Snisort in Skye the famous Maestur Ruari, called for leases and an increase of land to be granted to crofters. Quote, "I am of opinion that if the holdings of the people were enlarged and means could be found to provide for them by loan or otherwise, it would go far to mitigate the existing distress. To enable a man to maintain his family, he would require to have not less than 10 acres of arable land, besides grazing. I do not see, upon any equitable principle, how a lease can be refused to a small tenant when it is granted to a taxman. I have no doubt that if the smaller tenants could obtain leases, they would work their holdings more industriously and produce from the land they occupy a larger amount of food." End quote. During the 1860s and 1870s, the relative recovery of the Highland economy relegated land issues not only from off the ecclesiastical agenda, but also in the political arena. Yet crofting society remained fragile in this period, with a chronic shortage of land, no security of tenure, and consequently little or no incentive to improve one's house or holding. Simultaneously, the Free Church in the Highlands became increasingly alienated from the rest of the denomination, which began to move in a different direction, not only from conservative Highlanders, such as Dr. John Kennedy of Dingwall, but also from the old school Calvinism of Chalmers and Cunningham in the south. This heightening of a sense of distinctiveness in the religious sphere could only have reinforced the growing sense of the unity of the Highland people, which eventually burst forth with such remarkable vigour in the land agitation of the 1880s. In this lecture, it is only possible to give a brief overview of the extent of church involvement in the agitation. From the outset, churchmen were involved in the public debate over reform of the land system. John Macmillan, Free Church Minister of Lochbroom, orchestrated the public outcry against the Lech Melm evictions in 1880. Ministers were highly involved in the formation of the first branches of the Highland Land Law Reform Association, the future Highland Land League, in 1881 and 1882. The initial response of ministers on Skye to the disturbances at Braes, Glendale and on the Kilmure estate was one of caution. Undoubtedly, most Skye ministers were deeply disturbed and taken aback by the wave of agitation which swept the island in 1882. It was through ministerial influence, however, that the violence did not get out of hand. This was especially true in Glendale in early 1883. At an early stage of the land agitation, therefore, churchmen were involved in attempting to diffuse disturbances and conciliate between the crofters and the civil authorities. Hand in hand with this conciliatory role came an increasingly confident espousal of the crofters' cause in the flourishing local and national press, and a firm determination on the part of ministers to see crofters' grievances redressed by legislation. This is one of the ways in which the agitation of the 1880s differs from previous opposition to landlords. It was characterised by clearly defined political objectives, the support of a well-organised political movement, and it attracted considerable public sympathy beyond the Highlands. The involvement of ministers in the land issue was seen most visibly in the testimonies of 80 clergymen, including Roman Catholic priests, to the Napier Commission in 1883. The evidence gathered by the Napier Commission is the most valuable single source for the study of clerical attitudes to land reform. The proportion of clergymen who participated from across the region was the high figure of around 1 in 6. Their contributions suggest that the majority of Highland clergy were in favour of legislative intervention in order to extend Crofter's holdings and provide tenurial security. Indeed, the ministerial evidence generally corroborated the Crofters' own testimonies and shows how much the moral influence of the clergy added to the momentum in favour of reform. Furthermore, their support for land reform transcends the theological and denominational differences which then existed. One of the most telling indications of the importance of the ministers to the Crofters' case was the opposition of factors and the large tenant farmers. In the following quote, Donald Cameron, tenant farmer of Glenbrittle, Skye, very tellingly rails against the Crofters' delegates. Quote, I believe that they are inspired by the Free Church, and that these are the Fenians we have. Not the Free Church of the South, but the Free Church north of the Caledonian Canal. The Free Church that sent ignorant, unlettered men about the place to spread discontent among the people. The Gaelic and the Free Church and the want of education are the curse of Skye. End quote. The Free Church ministers of Bracadale, Snizort, Kilmuir, Slate and Rassie held very different opinions, however. They called for an end to eviction and emigration and sought a redistribution of land from men like Cameron back to the Crofters at fair rents. James Cumming, Free Church Minister of Melness, stated that Sutherland Crofters were living under an absolute despotism, and Gustavus Aird wondered why the government allowed Crofters to be treated as if they were serfs. Aird called for fixity of tenure, fair rents, compensation for improvement, and the redistribution of hill pasture for club farms. In Arisaig, the radical young established church minister, Donald MacCallum, quoting from Isaiah chapter 5, verse 8, justified his position in a manner which typifies the biblical rhetoric which he and other land reformers frequently adopted during the agitation. Quote, proprietors and sheep farmers try to live alone in the midst of the earth, and I, as a teacher of righteousness, am constrained to justify the ways of God to men by saying that the rapid succession of proprietors and managers on this one estate indicate a striking execution of the divine sentence. Woe unto them that join house unto house, that lay field unto field, until there be no room, that they may be placed alone in the midst of the earth. End quote. MacCallum self-consciously carved out a name for himself as the prophet of Highland land reform, especially after his move to Skye in 1884. MacCallum was a tireless activist on behalf of the Land Reform Association, and derived his anti-landlordism from a romanticised social gospel adapted to the conditions of the Crofters. The exclusive lionising of MacCallum as the great clerical supporter of land reform has overshadowed the contribution of the much larger body of Highland ministers who favoured reform but chose less ostentatious methods to achieve it. John Kennedy of Dingwall, for example, in an 1884 letter to Gustavus Aird, suggested that, quote, money should be provided by the government to meet the expense of trenching a sufficient amount of ground to furnish a 30-acre croft to each family with an outrun for cattle on hill pasture, end quote. Again, the fact that the Free Church Assembly continually passed resolutions in favour of land legislation demonstrates just how prevalent land reform sentiment was among churchmen. Had there not been an overall consensus in favour of reform, such resolutions would not have passed. What is also of note is the fact that the theological division in the Free Church made very little difference to ministers' attitudes to reform. Indeed, it was in the most conservative presbyteries of the North and West that the bulk of land reform resolutions were passed. This undermines the notion that only through the onset of theological liberalism were Presbyterians able to develop a proper theology of social involvement. Although tensions arose between more radical reformers and some of the ministers, it remains true that the initial proliferation of land reform association branches across the Highlands was greatly encouraged by ministerial involvement. Anti-clericalism there may have been at times, but it was never a predominant note in the Land League's battle cry. Fundamental to land reformers' rhetoric was the appeal to biblical authority for land redistribution, when this was married to the distinctive sense of Highland peoplehood and community, so prominent during the 1880s, it became a central plank of the reformers' ideology. The involvement of Presbyterian elders in the campaign is difficult to quantify, although it would appear that they were sometimes more outspoken than the ministers. Like Methodist laymen in England, it is probably true to say that participation in church services and administration prepared the elders to take a leadership role in local land politics. Notwithstanding a few notable exceptions, they have left little record of their involvement, however. It remains true that the number of ministers active and vocal on behalf of land reform was much greater proportionally than that of the eldership. Denominational affiliation also played an important role in clerical responses to the agitation. Roman Catholic priests were no more radical than their Presbyterian counterparts. South Uist certainly was at the scene of considerable unrest, in which the priests clearly sided with the crofters against the Gordon Cathcart estate management. Baptist, Episcopalian, and United Presbyterian ministers played very little public role in the agitation, with the exception of one or two individuals, such as Duncan MacGregor, the founder of the Scottish Land League of America. The greatest contrast is between the ministers of the establishment and of the Free Church. The established church was divided, with some strongly opposed to the agitation and still maintaining the need for emigration, with some others preferring to remain cautiously sceptical about the land reform solution. At the same time, a small group of younger ministers, like MacCallum, were more advanced than any of their contemporaries in their radicalism. This division hindered the established church from coming out vocally on behalf of the crofters' cause. The Free Church ministers, however, in keeping with the general position of the church from 1843 onwards, were hostile to eviction and emigration, and their support for land reform in the 1880s can be viewed as a further journey down the same road they had been travelling since the disruption. The high point of Free Church involvement in land reform was the special conference on the issue presided over by Gustavus Aird in Dingwall early in 1886. This Dingwall conference called for extensive redistribution of land to the crofters and for government aid to develop the region's infrastructure. Aird's motion stated, quote, "This conference is convinced that a measure should at once be passed to restore to and secure the full enjoyment by the Highland people on equitable conditions of their native land, of which Parliament and the Crown have in the Crofters Act already practically admitted that they should never have been deprived." The fact that this conclusion was reached well after the passing of the Crofters Act of 1886 clearly shows the depth of Free Church sympathy for the idea of the land for the people. This position anticipated the future direction of government policy in the Highlands. The Oban Times regarded the Dingwall resolution as a declaration of war against deer forests, which marks a new era in the history of the Highland churches. End quote. This prediction, however, remained unfulfilled, largely because the unique conditions of the 1880s were never again replicated. The Napier Commission and the Dingwall Conference thus represent the peak of ministerial involvement in the land question. Highland churchmen have never subsequently felt the need to speak out on social issues as pressingly as during the Crofters' War. How may we summarise the role of the church in relation to the clearances, and then to the agitation which was itself a product of the earlier crisis? There was clearly an ongoing development of social criticism in the Highland Church, and the disruption marks a clear watershed. Whilst a number of ministers did speak out before 1843, that number increased greatly with the formation of the Free Church. If the Highlands were largely viewed by evangelicals in the period before the disruption as a mission field, then it is only natural to expect that the spiritual missionary imperative would take precedence over more materialist intervention. By the 1870s and 80s, the religious position of the region was reversed in the minds of conservative evangelicals. The Highlands were now no longer a mission field, but rather a bastion of true religion. While the church's primary role was to provide for the spiritual needs of the people, churchmen could legitimately expect to advocate material solutions as well as purely spiritual ones. The aim was to improve the material welfare of the population in order to preserve the religious culture of the region. Highland clergymen of every denomination were deeply involved in the events of the clearances and land agitation. But it was the dominant voice of evangelicalism which set the prevailing tone. Hence we see a progressive criticism of the existing order, combined with a firm determination to maintain law and order. The motivations which lay behind the ministerial support for land reform were chiefly Christian compassion and philanthropy, together with a patriotic commitment to preserve the Highland way of life and a deep sense of the injustices of the clearances. This communitarian defence of the Highland people through land reform contradicts the widespread belief that Protestantism in general is intrinsically destructive of community solidarity, or more specifically, that Highland society was undermined by evangelicalism. Without the moral certainties and spiritual succour of evangelicalism, the Highland people would have fared a lot worse during the 19th century. The great achievements of famine relief and the provision of schooling have rightly been seen as two of the greatest legacies the Free Church bestowed on the Highlands in the secular sphere. But I would add a third. The simple fact that the campaign for land reform achieved its primary objectives without the loss of a single life. Thank you.